welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. I'm brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time.
This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Thank you for joining me once more on Listen to Older Voices. I'm Rob Greaves, and this is the fourth and final program featuring the life, times, and musical journey of 66-year-old Sam C. Music has been in Sam's blood since he was a boy. His father was a semi-professional bass player, and having been taught violin, piano, and cello as a boy, when the Australian music scene exploded into action in the early 1960s, Sam knew that this was for him. For music was more than just entertainment, it was an imperative. Like all professional musicians, he started out learning and experimenting with friends in various groups, gradually honing his skills as a keyboard player, guitarist, vocalist, and as we will learn this week, as a songwriter. Sam's story is entertaining, it's educative, and he shares his experiences and memories, giving us many behind-the-scenes stories. In this final program, we begin to confirm our suspicions that Sam C is indeed a very talented man whose successes have come about through a combination of natural talent and hard work. With compositions behind him, such as Reasons, a mega hit for Johnny Farnham, his career now continues with his longtime friend and collaborator and well-known Australian artist, Glyn Mason. I'll feature a Sam C composition played by Sam and Glyn at the end of the program. But now we pick up with Sam talking about how after many years living and working overseas, he knew it was time to return to Australia.
I was keen to come back. I hadn't been back by that point for about 5 or 6 years. My parents were getting older and I wanted to see my family and friends. I should just say, and lost a lot of friends along the way from my 20s because life, you know, people change.
You move on, yes.
And I've always felt sad about that, you know, because you make these friends young. Some of us are lucky enough to keep a handful. And I have, you know, a few still, but it's... Anyway, so we came back to Australia, did the trip with Greg Quill. It wasn't a great success, and he had met a Canadian lady by that point and decided he was going to return back to Canada. And I said, well, I ain't. We'd recruited Chris Stockley into the band. He'd been fired by the Dingoes and was at a loose end. So we'd recruited him up in Canada and he was never going back to Canada. He was determined to move back to the glory days of the Station Hotel and his buddies in Melbourne. And he was at me to sort of stay in Australia. You know, he just said, look, there's a lot more opportunity. And I could see from the day we came back to Australia, it was just alive and vibrant compared to Toronto.
Oh, right.
Toronto had sort of degenerated into bar bands and all of those great acts like Joni Mitchell and the Band and Neil Young and so forth that had been very healthy in 71-2, had all moved to LA, and what was left was not really happening. So there I was, 78, I guess it was, and Stockley and I were at very much a loose end. I spent a few nights after I was kicked out of the car hotel on the street, and because I was too proud to call my parents and say, can you loan me a few bucks? Thank you to the Salvation Army for feeding me for a few days. And in the end, Stockley said, look, we should just put another band together. I'm going, well, that's what I kind of do. It's exactly what I do. And in his words, he said, but we need the Golden Throat. At this stage, I'd sort of started getting to the point where I wanted to sing my own songs, but I certainly recognise I'm no Ray Charles and I've just got the four good notes that God gave me. And I understand what Chris was on about. And he said, what about Glyn Mason? And I said, oh, yeah, well, he's a great singer. I remembered him from you know, sherbet days. So we called Glyn up and he was free. So we put together Stockley C and Mason, and that's probably another saga that we don't have time for.
No, but it's a story in itself almost. But it was, for a short time, a very successful outfit, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think
to live.
Very much. We put the band together as quick as any band I've put together ever. And I'd say we had one rehearsal with the rhythm section, and we did our first gig supporting Sports, maybe. And the agency were there and they said, oh, yeah. So they got us a bunch of gigs. And in those days, we were doing at least four and often six and seven gigs a week. So that is a way to make a band tight.
Yes.
That doesn't exist anymore. So we were just having a fabulous time. And I think we really, the sad thing about that band, and I heard the record recently, is that we came out at a time when it was punk was the flavour of the month.
Yes.
We definitely weren't that. We were kind of a country-ish, rockish band. But, boy, were we good live. You know, we were sensational, yeah. I think. And anyway, so ultimately, just that band stayed together for nearly 2 years. And Glyn was the first to sort of become discontented with you know, this continual round of doing gigs, and we were just starting to crack it, you know, whatever it was. We were just starting to break through, and he decided to leave, you know, and I remember coming home and saying, you know, I can't believe this, but he's leaving, you know. And I later found out that he'd sort of left a few bands like that, but I understand, you know, I understood later on that Glyn's the sort of person who likes it to be fun and happy, you know, like he works very hard, but when it became unhappy, he just didn't want to be around anymore. So he shot through, and we tried for a while with a couple of other guys. One notable bloke was Chris Copping. We got in as a keyboard player, and I hated that band. It just wasn't working for me. We had a singer and I wanted to sing my own songs. It was probably, you know, like, it was probably me growing up, really, and just deciding this is what I want to do, not, you know. But anyway, so I said to Stockley and our manager, either those two guys go and we continue on as a four-piece, or I've got to go, you know. So they said, well, you have to fire them, you know, and I, what? Me? So I remember agonising over that overnight, called them in for a meeting, and the singer was outraged, you know, that he was being given his notice. And thank God, I'll never forget, Chris Copping just said, well, Sam, you know, that's rock and roll. Sometimes you lose, and sometimes you lose.
Oh, dear.
So he let me
on. On one hand, it's chintzy philosophy, but on the other hand, it's so bloody true.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, like, I mean,
good response.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure Chris ever forgave me entirely, but no, we're good friends now.
Yeah.
And that's the way it was. And so that band, the four-piece Stockley C and Mason, was probably the best Stockley C and Mason, but by that point, we'd burnt our bridges. Anyway, that came to an end. And Glyn and I started working not as the Pardoners as we do now, but we were working as the Stuka Brothers. Our motto was, nobody bombs like the Stukas. That's how stupid we
were. That was hardly an inducement to be hired, was it?
Oh, no, unbelievable. But
did that reflect actually a state of mind you were in then?
No.
No, it was just a comedy, just a joke.
Yeah, yep. And the joke was taken a bit too seriously by, you know, Brolga, who played his bass with Goanna.
Yes.
He got into it and he got the girls to make swastika armbands. Oh. He sort of induced us to do a gig supporting Goanna. We played a set, then Robbie and he played. He had a khaki shirt with his swastika armband as the Junkers. band.
Sorry, I missed that.
Glenn and I were looking at each other going, what? How crazy is he? Anyway, so, so we did the Stukas for a while. Then John Farnham called. Bang. You know, I ended up being John. They'd lost this hack guitar player, John Farnham's band, called Tommy Emmanuel. So that was a big call for me to replace him, and I played in that band for a couple of years until our bass player died in a car accident. And suddenly, John, we were going to do an album of mostly my material, and John and I were writing together, and then suddenly he was in LIB.
Wow.
So I was back on my bum again.
Had you written...
Oh, Reason.
Yeah, sorry.
No, I hadn't, no.
So had Reason come on the scene at that stage?
No.
That was later, yeah. Right.
So I think that was the last straw for me as far as wanting to be in bands and do all that stuff, because not that I blamed John for joining LIB, it was theoretically a great opportunity for him. And we were great mates, and, you know, I got married in his backyard. But I'm just trying not to sound bitter here. But it was just, you know, I'd put everything into that band and and the new songs, and it suddenly came to naught. So I decided, well, screw it, I'm not doing bands anymore. I'm just going to play in the studio. So that started opening up for me, I suppose, largely thanks to Ernie Rose from Armstrongs. And I started doing jingles and playing on records and stuff like that. And it was much more of a challenging thing, you know, to be thrown into the deep end of playing in the studio, even though I'd been there a lot, obviously, in bands, but sort of playing stuff that you weren't familiar with and trying to produce a result. And I started learning, I suppose, about being an engineer and all the studio life entails.
Which at that stage you hadn't had to deal with.
Not really.
But it turned out to actually be a godsend, didn't it?
Well, it did, but I don't think I, you know, it was never my ambition to be an engineer. I sort of became one by default out of necessity when computerised music came on the scene, because my chosen engineers are trying to make a living and you can't afford it. And I do enjoy some aspects of engineering. I must say I don't really enjoy often producing myself. I wish I had somebody who would be there as I do, say, with Glenn, you know, because Glenn's sort of free to be an artist when he's singing, whereas I have to have a couple of hats on.
Yes.
I'm not the Robinson Crusoe there. A lot of people are in the same boat, but it's less satisfying, I guess, you know, and it's less heartfelt sometimes, because you have to be thinking, oh, this, how's this all working? And that's really the job of a producer, whatever a producer is these days.
Now, the fact of the matter is that you currently are working with Glenn in a very successful duo, but for those of us who are listening to this and listen back and think back, the time you worked with Glenn in terms of Stock, Lucie and Mason, it ended abruptly and ended basically with Glenn walking out.
Yeah.
Did that not leave a bitter taste in your mouth?
I was mystified.
So how did you get back together?
Well, no, I mean, we already got back together in the Stukas.
Oh, in the Stukas, yeah, that's right, yes.
And that was a surprise too, that he called out of the blue and said, I'm doing some gigs, do you want to do something? I'm going, well, I thought you'd left the band, you know, but Glenn's his own man, and I was never bitter about him leaving Stock, Lucie and Mason.
Confused?
I was. I think having done all the hard yards, we suddenly seem, you know, punk seemed to have died down a bit, and some of the shocking bands whose names I won't even glorify had gone away, and we were starting to make, you know, break through a bit.
But you mentioned that Glenn's major reason for leaving was that it just wasn't fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, it sounds like the Stukas brothers had quite a bit of fun.
Well, it was just covers, you know. I mean, we were... it was fun. And, you know, Glenn and I think even in the Stock, Lucie and Mason band, had discovered our blend, you know. I mean, Glenn's one of the great tenors that's ever been in our country, and he and I sing great together. So when we started doing the Stukas, which was, you know, sort of a haphazard thing like the Pardoners was originally, it was more just, you know, faith.
Now, you keep mentioning the Pardoners. That's your current outfit with you and Glenn.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, that came about, at that point, I had a studio in my house in Glen Iris, and I was doing ads and music for videos and stuff like that. He used to come down, he'd moved to Sydney long, you know, 10 years before that, not probably more. He used to come down when he was repping for Fender. He would pop round for dinner, and he came down one night and he said, oh, you know, I'm travelling solo from now on. In other words, his marriage had broken up, and I'm moving back to Melbourne, which made sense because I think a lot of his dearest friends, amongst whom I include myself, were down here. So suddenly he decided he was moving back, and that was that. In the meantime, I'd done an album of my guitar pieces, acoustic guitar pieces, and that was a major frustration for me because they were orchestrated and I couldn't do them without a band. I couldn't afford to hire the band to do it properly. So I was kind of there. I said, look, I'm doing some gigs, but if you feel like it, do you want to have a crack? And so we started, and, you know, that was 12 years ago and we're still rocking. Yeah. And we sort of, frankly, we've failed to achieve the level of popularity that I still believe we deserve. But nonetheless, we're making the best music I think we've ever made. So, yaboo, catch up, anyone who's hearing this. But
I certainly intend to play some bits of the Pardoners. And looking back at this journey, the 12 years with you and Glenn together, I mean, I'm telling you something you know. It's a very unique combination, both in terms of your musical abilities and particularly your vocal abilities, that they blend so well together.
Yeah.
Do you think it's more a reflection of where music in Australia is at the moment rather than your inability to produce good music?
I think it's our inability to market. Like, Glenn and I are the worst managers in show business history, but it's also a function of our age. You know, like, I wouldn't expect a 20-year-old person to come out and hear us play. It's not their thing. I think music seems to be very, for that generation of people, where it seems to be background noise.
Yes.
And an accompaniment to whatever they're doing. Whereas for a 66-year-old man next week, I think music was just the epicentre of my whole growing up, you know, from even before the Beatles, you know, the music my dad played and then the rock and roll that came from England and then finding out where the rock and roll that came from England came from. And the blues and all that, those things that you discover, they were central to who I am and what I was interested in my whole life. So I've never quite come to terms with the fact that we're not all like that. You know, a lot of people, my sister who I adore, just music's neither here nor there for her. You know, I think she likes it to dance to at a party. Occasionally, yes, but yes. It's not
an imperative.
No, not at all.
Our time's nearly up. Before we do finish up, say, looking forward to the future, and except if that bus hits you down the road,
yeah,
you've still got quite a few years left yet in your life. Do you foresee music continuing to be a major part of your life for the rest of your life?
I think it certainly will be my life. Whether it's me sharing it with other people continues to prevail enough for us to keep doing it. You know, I'm not sure. Rob, I think if we're lucky, we'll find some angel who'll sort of spread the word. You know, we do have a couple of people who are trying to break us out of this sort of little nest that we live in enough to make us sort of viable as an act, you know, and it's bloody hard for everyone of our age. I know, talking to other friends who are well-known It's just not that easy anymore. But no, I'm playing till they drag me out of here.
Yeah. It's all ironical, isn't it? Because, again, if you go back to the United States, some of the most loved musicians are those that are in the 70s, 80s.
Yeah.
That not just survive but have grown and continue to grow. Yet in Australia, it's almost like a disposable part of our
society. Well, maybe. But I think also, you know, Glenn and I were... I was going to say sucked into it. Glenn and I were subsumed into doing the Axiom 40th year reunion, which featured Brian Cadden, Glenn Shorrock, both of whom have successful solo careers. And if you think about it, those acts you're talking about are people who had single success.
True.
In the 70s.
True.
So Glenn... with the Twilights and then with LRB, and Brian with the group and then as in his own right. The LRB were a very big act, but Brian was never huge, but he had those few songs to hang his hat on. Whereas Glenn and I mean, the only hit I have really is Reasons, which I wrote for John Farnham.
Listen to Older Voices, Ageless Radio.
Thank God for it. You know, not only did I have royalties when royalties existed, but at least people know it, and it's something, you know, but it's... Glenn doesn't really have that, you know, and he should have, but he doesn't. So I think that's, you know, if you look at the people... in the States that you're talking about, they're all people who'd had careers when they had hair.
Sam C, hairless as you are, thank you very much for the time you've given us, and thank you for being on the program.
You're more than welcome. Have a good life.
Thank you.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program. Listen to Older Voices is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is podcast to you through the Toorak Times and TAG.